and welcome to another episode of Talking to Change, a motivational interviewing podcast. My name is Sebastian Kaplan, and I'm in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, USA. And as always, joined by my good friend, Glenn Hines in Derry, Northern Ireland. Good morning. Well, for me, good morning, Glenn.
Yeah, good afternoon from me, Seb. How are you doing, man?
Doing well. So again, we are, as always, excited about today's episode and our conversation that will be forthcoming soon. But before we get started with that, Glenn, please orient everybody to the ways that they can access our podcast and communicate with us.
Fantastic. Our Twitter is at Change Talking. Our Facebook page is Talking to Change. Our Instagram is Talking to Change Podcast. And for direct conversations with ourselves or feedback or questions, our email address is podcast@glennhines.com.
That Instagram page is kind of new, and we've gotten some pretty good feedback about it, huh?
Yeah, it's been very well done. It's actually been managed by my daughter, Maeve, so I just want to give a shout out to Maeve. It's fantastic. We're getting some great feedback. And we'd really appreciate more people to come along and like and comment and offer some feedback as well.
That's right. Maeve's doing a wonderful job with that, and some good content there. All right. Well, moving along. So, like I said, we're excited about this episode today, where we will explore arguably one of the more challenging conversations that professionals of any kind have with clients that they're serving, and the topic around suicide prevention. And so we're very pleased to welcome Emma Braconnier to the podcast. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, or good afternoon here as well.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. Well, we're excited to have you. And as we've been doing recently, we can just get started. Tell us a bit about yourself, what you do, and then also let us know what your early MI story was.
Yeah, so a bit about me. I'm a social worker, among other things, but that's my profession that I work with today. And I don't work clinically anymore, and I haven't for some time. So I work with quality development within the social services throughout the field, actually. And now I work mainly with kids. So quality development within, you know, child and youth prevention and social work with kids and up to 18. So I've been through the field, and now the youth.
Right. So, and these are through agencies in throughout Sweden.
So in Sweden, we have, you know, the social services are organized in municipalities, the communes. I think it's the same word in English as well, that organizes. So I work with a special municipality, and then I do MI trainings, you know, on my other half. So I both have an employment, and then I also do MI trainings throughout Sweden and some internationally as well. And mainly healthcare, social work, but also the police and a lot of people who are non-professionals as well, like women's shelters and volunteering at stuff, volunteering at, you know, women's shelters or at the suicide support line or stuff like that as well. So it's quite a range of people that I train in MI, from people who have no training in, you know, meeting people professionally, but in healthcare and social services. And I think that's really exciting doing that. So MI trainings I do throughout the field and throughout Sweden, but through myself, through my own company. Yeah. Yeah.
So it sounds like there's an interest across Sweden and perhaps even further in motivational interviewing that's not just restricted to the professional practices. It's individuals who are supporting others in different realms, and that maybe are doing it out of goodwill or maybe doing it because of their own experience and they're giving back, but you've been given the opportunity to spend time with them and to teach them motivational interviewing. And that's perhaps something we can tease a bit more out with you later on. But tell us a bit more then about how you came to motivational interviewing yourself.
Yeah, so I started working at municipality with when I had finished school with social work. I was 29. That's quite late today in Sweden. You have your degree at 22, 23, so I was a bit older. But I started working with something called economic aid. You know, you're supposed to give economic aid to people who can't support themselves. And it's also housing and a lot of stuff in that. And it's a lot of decision making. You have to really make a lot of decisions about, are people going to get economic aid or are they not? And it's also the key thing that you're supposed to do when working with economic aid is actually to motivate people to have their income from somewhere else, to maybe to look for jobs, or maybe, you know, if they're too sick, to, you know, get them through the healthcare system so they can have economic aid from the state providing, or the social security system. So what we're supposed to do is motivate people. So that's quite interesting, as well as making really hard decisions. And I started working in a municipality that were, it was called a model municipality for MI, actually, through the National Board of Social Work and Healthcare. And so 2 or 3 days in, when I started my new job, I went to a two-day basic training of MI, and we had peer supports at every unit. So we trained MI at least once every month. And I thought MI was really hard at one point, but the spirit of MI really came to me. I felt that it put words to stuff that I experienced on how to be a social worker, what I wanted to be as a social worker. And throughout my education as a social worker, I always focused on how do we meet people regarding how they want to be met, not what I think is a good way to meet them. So I think MI really struck a chord in me. And at the same time, it was hard. You know, I worked in an area with high unemployment rates, a lot of people really, really poor, and, you know, a lot of criminality, and people were really struggling. But my manager and everyone else were really keen on MI. And we had some Minties actually in our team. But when I really found that it was working, I remember being at a family's house, and only the dad were home, and they'd been through a lot of stuff. And we talked about his children. And, you know, he began crying when he talked about his children, as many people do. And I think I just made a reflection saying, your kids are really important to you, and you want to be a good role model for them. And then he started crying some more. And then when I left, he said, I don't consider you my social worker. I consider you my friend. And, you know, in Sweden, it's, oh, you're not supposed to be your friend when being a social worker. And then thinking about it, I think he really meant you're being friendly. And he wasn't used to that. And I think he felt that I saw him. And, you know, and also another time I remember sitting with another family, and the dad said, I have plans to do this and this. And in my head, yeah, I'm going to say this, I have nothing better for you. Yeah, I thought, well, we've tried everything and nothing that we've come up with works. I didn't say that out loud, but in my head, I said that. And I thought, yeah, we'll try it your way. Of course, we will. This sounds like a great idea. Then they never came back because they've solved their situation by him going to, you know, doing some unpaid job. And then it led to a paid job. So we didn't have to give him economic aid anymore. So, you know, trusting the person's own ability and that they know themselves what they should do. So maybe a bit about social work is not us enhancing or trying to find which is the path for you. Not fucking it up. No, I'm swearing in your podcast. I'm sorry.
I think that might be. I'm not sure if that's the first, but we'll certainly include it.
That might be the first one. Solid work.
But I've heard that people who are cursing are more intelligent. So, So I'll blame it on my Swedish.
Well, I think as well as that, people will fully understand what you mean by that when you say that. You know, it's a universal description of when things are falling apart, and in a way that really impacts on the individual's sense of the relationship. I think that, you know, there's a passion in that word that communicates the experience of what's happening, and it sounds like what you're describing is that, you know, the temptation is for people who practice social work or other help and interventions to recognize people's lives falling apart in that way, and feel that somehow that it's our responsibility to hold that together or to put the pieces back together. But what you're describing is that having been submerged in the culture of motivational interviewing from the very beginning of your professional practice, even while it was hard, you began to see it be effective, and that what was quite striking for you was that when you gave the individual space to resolve things for themselves, they did it in a quite a rapid and unexpected way, and that in a fucked up situation it got resolved by themselves.
Yeah, I think it is. It's believing that the other person has what it takes, and it's not my job to fix them. That's sometimes really, really hard. And I want to say I still struggle with that. And many times, you know, we want to fix things when they're hard for someone else. And at the same time, knowing that I can't fix you because maybe you're not broken, you feel broken.
Hmm.
I get to spend maybe, if I'm lucky, an hour a week with that person, or maybe once a month, or I don't know how much. It depends on where you work, of course. But I mean, there's 30 other days of the month that I don't get to see, and you have to be on your own those days. And I can, in my way of talking to you, help you find your way and your strength and your struggles. I think that's what's come to me over the years, that, you know, really affirm the struggle, even though the result may not be as well as you would like it to be, or the result is really, really bad. I mean, we do struggle. And to maybe connect to what we're going to talk about today, that's a professor in Sweden who has worked with suicide prevention for not 150 years, but maybe 50, called Jan Beskow. And he said, people who are thinking about suicide are struggling really, really hard not to take their lives. And I think in the line of social work, or wherever we are meeting people that acknowledge their struggle, and they're lifting that forward. And even though you've struggled and feel like you haven't found your way or whatever, you'll still keep on going. I mean, what a person. And I've met a lot of people who have come from other countries to Sweden. And I mean, they've been through on a boat, they've been on some kind of hidden in the backseat of a car, or walked, you know, far, 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 and without money and without family and everything. And, you know, what powers do they have? It's a superpower. And giving that back, that you see all the struggles a person are doing, even though they feel that the result isn't a good thing. I mean, sometimes we really, really struggle and we don't get any results. I think we all have this lifestyle changes. We probably want to make, you maybe want to quit smoking or do a bit more exercise or eat healthier. And then you don't succeed in that. You don't lose your pounds or whatever it is you want to do. And I think we can all feel that, oh, I've been struggling. I've been trying so hard and nothing works. So if we can connect that, change is hard. It's really, really hard. Within us, yeah.
So many valuable lessons, I feel like, already just in your brief story there, and just starting to get into the world of suicide prevention, but just trying to reflect back on them a little bit there. And I guess I also want to express appreciation for your transparency in how you share those some of those early experiences and sort of the struggle with the early learning that you had, but also some of the ways that you were processing those conversations. You know, the person after that affirmation about parenting, he calls you a friend, and that got that initial level of like, oh no, that's bad, or that's not what we're supposed to be. Like, you were able to reframe that a bit and think of it less as the threat of friendship, which might be a whole other conversation to be had about how threatening really is that, but just viewing it from the lens of you interacting with him in a way that few people did up to that point, maybe, and that there was something really powerful for him about just how you interacted with him. And then even, you know, sharing what was going on inside your head with the next person about, you know, you had run out of ideas, and how that practitioners always have that opportunity to support someone else's autonomy and trust their own strengths, and even affirming the struggles that they've had up until the point of that conversation that you're having with them. So just wanted to appreciate that. And these are likely some threads that will continue through our conversation today, as we're talking about people who are really struggling.
Yeah, I think you're right, Seb. I think that's it. And I think I'm continuously struggling. You know, that's a little voice in my head saying, don't say that, don't say that, don't say that. And yeah, and sometimes I do.
Mm.
So I think it's a continuous struggling, being an empathic person. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's just what you were saying there, that it's recognizing that the one thing that we share is a struggle in our own lives, and that's the human thread that connects us all. We're all striving to be our best selves, and what you have been describing is that once you began to recognize and be encouraged to recognize each individual's struggle, that you were able to recognize the effort that they were making in that struggle, and that you were able to identify the superpowers, whether they be their strengths or their talents. But ultimately, and maybe leading into the conversation now, exploring suicide prevention, is even just that idea that someone who is considering taking their own life is considering it. And because they're considering it, there's another side to the conversation that they're having with themselves. And it sounds like that's part of what you're leaning towards, which is, yes, acknowledging the challenge and the pain and potentially the opportunity that death would offer them, but also the fact that they haven't taken that path yet would seem to suggest that they're working very hard to maintain their life. And that's the bit that you become interested in, is about what is it you're exploring and striving. And maybe you could say a bit more about that then, Emma, about how you begin or how you use that curiosity, leaning in that direction to explore someone's desire for life while they talk about taking their life.
Yeah, and so in suicide prevention, the researchers, at least in Sweden, I think it's universal, talk about that people are really, really ambivalent. And that's what we're talking about in MI. We feel often two things about the change we're about to make. I both want to and I don't want to. And the ambivalence in suicide is, or considering if life is worth living, is really, really high, because the stakes are so much higher. And I'm going to use an example from Ludmila Rosengren. Yeah, so I'm going to use some Swedish words. She's the founder of another organization called Suicide Zero, and her daughter took her life when she was 15. And the day before she took her life, she also applied for summer work. So, I mean, summer work is really forward-looking, and suicide is not. So what I want to do in the conversation is help them get back to how come you applied for summer work and how is that important, or where is that leading you? Is it okay if I just take some numbers about suicide, at least how it is in Sweden? So in Sweden, it's about 1,500 each year that take their own lives. And we also in Sweden counts as something called unsure suicides, but that's 1,500. And that's the statistics that's used. And per suicide, about 10 more people have tried to take their lives. And about per suicide, about 100 people have had plans to take their lives. And about 1,000 more have had thoughts about suicide. And if you're a quick, if you do your math, 1,500 times 1,000 is 1.5 million people. And that's 15% of the Swedish population that have had thoughts about taking their lives. And in Sweden, you can fill out some kind of form. So it's statistically proven that about 15% have had thoughts about if life is worth living. So when you think about it, 15% is quite a lot of people. We talk about, you know, the people who actually take their lives. And also, we forget the whole big group that aren't feeling good. And I think we all have someone, or maybe a few people that we know have taken their lives or tried. I have many people in my environment or in my background that have tried and also succeeded. And it's also by those who have tried to take their life, 9 out of 10 die from something completely different. If they fail from taking their lives, 9 out of 10 die from something, you know, like everyone else. And almost everyone who tries to take their life or have taken their lives have had contact with the healthcare or in the social work services or something like that. So they have told people about what they think. And I think that's really hopeful. A lot of people are thinking dark thoughts. And also a lot of people express it, and also a lot of people are feeling better. I think we have a great deal of something we can work with. So if we can talk to people a bit earlier, a lot can change. So I think it's hopeful that many people that have tried the majority, they die from something else. Only 1 out of 10 tried before die from suicide. So I think that's quite hopeful as well, that people are really struggling to, they want to feel better. They want to have a life. And also, as I mentioned before, Jan Beskow, who is, you know, a suicide psychiatric researcher, he says, he doesn't talk about suicide. He talks about psychological accidents. And I think that's quite nice. And also, you know, you feel so trapped and you're caught in your dark emotions and you find no way out. And you don't really have connections with your thoughts, your all emotions. And I think in the line of the conversations, you have to help them to get in touch with your emotions as well. I think Rory talked about it a bit, I think it was 2 podcasts ago, that sometimes it's, you know, all feelings and you have to help them up a bit. So you're also connected with your thoughts, because then you might realize that it's right now I'm feeling hopeless. And then, yeah, I also applied for summer work yesterday. And that's what we're often trying to do with MI, acknowledging the thoughts and the feelings, and they're put together. And sometimes they don't go in the same direction.
So, well, thank you for providing the context, I suppose, in Sweden, at least, and just really just thinking about that number, if 15% of an entire country throughout the year will have some level of difficulty to the extent that taking their life becomes an option. And I guess there's a couple places to settle into that number. One is just sort of feeling the power of that and maybe even overwhelmed at how huge a number that is. And you also offer a counter to that, I guess, which is the opportunity that not only the people themselves have, and that more often than not, the vast majority of the people that are struggling in that way don't end up completing suicide, and they go on to live a life. Now, perhaps it's a life with some continued struggles involved, but they're, at least from the standpoint of suicide, they have, that is not ultimately what ends most people's lives who are struggling in this way. And it also provides an opportunity for the practitioner to really respond in a way that meets their needs and sort of helps them forward. Of course, for people that are working with practitioners. And I wonder if it might be helpful also to say, because I feel like practitioners of any kind that are in conversation with someone who's considering suicide or sharing that they're having thoughts or whatever it might be, there's some really unique challenges that practitioners have in those conversations. And perhaps even there are parts of those conversations that there's a requirement, right? That there are elements in these conversations that have to happen either by law or by policy of some agency. And I wonder if we could talk a bit about what are some of those pressures the practitioners might face and how MI can inform practitioners and maybe even provide other avenues to interact when we're dealing with such high stakes kinds of situations.
I don't think there are that many, you know, like pressures from agencies and stuff actually to ask about if they have had thoughts about it. Sometimes, you know, you have this form you fill in and that's a question, do you have had thoughts about suicide? And that's it. And then you don't really, as a practitioner, know how to handle it. So we in Sweden, we have several support lines you could call in and talk to people. So this is a real struggle that we're having. I don't think practitioners ask enough about, have you had thoughts about taking your life? And we also have, you know, investigations showing that from people taking their lives, they haven't always been asked. And there's a lot of myths about suicide that people who are considering it don't speak, and they do. Almost everyone talks about it, that they're considering taking their lives. And there's also a myth that it's dangerous to ask about suicide, that it will get into your head and then you will think, oh, suicide is an option. And that's also a myth. So I think we're afraid to talk to people who look, or we get the notion that they're not feeling well. And it's dare to ask if life is worth living. And it's also daring to listen to the response as well. Because just asking and then, you know, yeah. And then you don't know what to do with the answer. Then, you know, then you might feel, oh, this wasn't really worth, you know, telling you. You don't give anything back. So it's, I think in suicide prevention and in the use of MI or whatever you want to use, it's daring to listen to what the other person is saying, because I think it's our own emotions that get so triggered that we don't know what to say. And I don't want to say the wrong thing. And then I don't say anything at all. So we often say it's a hard conversation. And I, you know, when we talked about me getting on here, I've been thinking, to whom is it a difficult conversation? I think it's actually more difficult for me as the practitioner than the person who's feeling this, because my experience is they want to be listened to. They want to be heard. They want to be acknowledged. They want someone to see you and that they're feeling like this, because they say it, you know. And I think we're afraid to do maybe something wrong or maybe trigger something, and then we don't say anything. And I think that's a really key element. Who am I in this? And how do I respond? And I think something I'm going to... Rory said in your podcast two podcasts ago, I really like that one. I liked many. He said, it's not always about being the best at empathy. It's just not being the worst. I went to the local swimming pool, indoor swimming pool yesterday with my son, who's two. And he was supposed to have a snack, so he had some Swedish pancakes. And then he's not a big eater, so that always stresses me, you know. I want him to eat some more. And then he ate some pieces, and then he poured his water on his plate. So, you know, the pancakes are all soggy. And he had a plastic fork, and he was supposed to pick the pancake pieces up. And, you know, he picks them up with the fork, and they fall off, and they fall off, and they fall off. And I just want to pick the pancake up and put it in his mouth. Yeah. And I really had to talk to myself, don't do it, Emma. Don't pick the pancake up and try to put it in his mouth. He won't eat it. And that, you know, he was really, really struggling. And several times he was, I can't do it. I can't do it. And then he continued trying and trying and trying, and he got some pieces in. So I think in MI, we often talk about the writing reflex, or we want to fix things. And I think it was so clear to me yesterday that I tried to, you know, fix him by putting that pancake piece on his fork and put it in his mouth, and he wouldn't have eaten anything. And I really had to talk to myself, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, Emma. And he continued, you know, like struggling, maybe 10 minutes actually. And I think if I'm struggling that hard with my kid trying to eat some pancakes, you know, with my writing reflex, the stakes are so much higher when, you know, we're talking to someone who are considering if life is worth living. So I think our writing reflex is so aroused. I don't know if that's the right word, but it's so high up. And I think it's really, really important to try to connect with your writing reflex and try to not use it, actually. Because every advice you be giving someone who's considering if life is worth living will seem, you know, like too small or too shallow. And as I said before, we maybe get to spend an hour with the person or maybe more, but they've lived a whole life. So I think the writing reflex is triggered when we see people are hurting. And I mean, I saw that when my kid trying to eat some pancakes. I was really trying to, you know, get him to eat some more pancakes. And that's a really small thing. So I just wanted to illustrate that that's what happens to us when people are struggling. And when it's such a big thing, because it could be about life and death, and we don't have all the time in the world, then we want to say the thing that will solve your problem. And, you know, being a volunteer and talking to people who've met many professionals say that, you know, the advice they've been given has felt like, oh, you should take a walk, you know, physical activity is really good. And it's really good for people. Yeah, I mean, we all know we feel better with physical activity. And at the same time, if you say, I'm thinking about taking my life, oh, you should take a walk. I mean,
yeah,
that's too small. So whatever we might say, or if they say, I've tried everything and nothing works, instead of, you know, like, have you really tried everything? That's not the point.
Sure.
The feeling of feeling that you've tried everything and you haven't found what really works for you yet. And how come you tried this far? Or maybe just, it sounds like you haven't found anyone who's been able to listen to you the way you want. And thank you for trusting me. I mean, what a way to, you know, to look about the struggles the person are making. So I think the really important thing when you're talking to someone in that kind of state, be aware of what I'm feeling and not trying to project that or say to them.
Mm. I love what you described there as the daring to listen. You know, I think it's a wonderful description, and I think beautifully encapsulates the challenge for us as practitioners. And you were describing there who's this conversation difficult for. And, you know, even in your description of your response to your son's dilemma at the swimming pool, that in some ways it's beginning to answer, I think, one of the questions that we got on Twitter from Natalie Finch, whose handle is Nat Finch Leads. And she was asking the question, how to manage myself, and more particularly that rolling with resistance. And it sounds like that it's that not giving an answer to this problem, but paying attention. It's the thing that you're going to give is your attention. What you're going to give is your willingness to listen, to understand without trying to fix. Back again to that believing in this other person's own resourcefulness and to really support their own self-determination to make a decision for themselves, knowing that there is an energy driving them towards life, and how do we get them to talk themselves through that, into that. And that idea, if we don't want to open the door, and I think a lot of people will recognize that, they may be working in different realms where from time to time someone will present with this really challenging proposition, which is, I'm going to kill myself. And they'd come in to talk about housing, or they'd come in to talk about a bunion, or they'd come in to talk about weight loss, and then they drop this, what a practitioner would call a bombshell, I'm going to take my own life. And I suppose one of the questions that I imagine a lot of people are curious about then, Em, is how did you get to the place where you could begin to tolerate that feeling, that panic, I imagine, and hold it long enough for you then to be in a place where you could actually listen to the client describe their suicidal thoughts and everything else that was going on for them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I'm really trying to acknowledge when I'm being judgmental to other people. And I'm being that as well as many other people do. And I think I'm struggling more with other stuff. I've never really had a difficulty with people feeling really, really, really bad. And, you know, people yelling at me, then I can, you know, handling the Discord, what we're saying in MI now. Or when I look back, I've had more trouble when I think their problem seems too small. Yeah. So that's what I need to be aware of. Am I really listening now? And I think we've all had struggles in our lives. We never know what those struggles are. And people might look really happy from the outside. I think if we just take two suicides who's been in Sweden and Norway, the former husband of the princess of Norway decided to take his life on Christmas Day. And, you know, he seems successful writer and everything. And also the husband of one of the ministers in Sweden decided to take his life. And he was also a successful person. And so we can look at people, they look happy from the outside or something like that. And at the same time, we don't know the struggle a person has been through. And I've had my struggles, and I think not liking who I was at that time, and no one could have disliked me as much as I did. And I think that connecting to that this person is, you know, in a really bad place, and connecting with struggles you've been through yourself, and not thinking that I know what you're feeling, because I don't, connecting with the hurt and feeling misunderstood and not listened to, and connecting to how does that feel? You know, reflecting that back to that person with reflecting the emotions you think they might have. So I think I'm struggling more with people who are not saying out loud that they're feeling this bad, but they're calling the suicide support line, and they talk about, you know, a movie they've been to. And some days I have a really struggling, you know, oh, probably someone more important that I should talk to.
Mm.
And I really have to connect with, we all have different ways of saying that we're feeling bad. But if you're calling a support line for suicide prevention, then you're not feeling your best and you need someone to talk to. And how you say that, if it's, I want to talk about a movie I've been to for 15 minutes, or I'm feeling so bad right now, I'm thinking about, you know, taking all these pills I have at home. So I'm struggling more with being empathic with the person who's not saying, the it's really, really bad now, right now, everything is hopeless, I can't find a way out, because I don't know. I'm judging the person based on how they speak. I need to be careful more with people who are not speaking that they're feeling that bad, and at the same time underneath I could hear it, and I mean they're calling a support line. So maybe also connecting to that, a lot of people are feeling really, really bad, and how they say that is different. So I'm struggling more with, you know, being an empathic when I feel, oh, this is a smaller problem or something like that. That's judgmental from my part, and I'm really trying not to be.
So, you know, something that is resonating with me, and it goes back to that phrase that, you know, Glenn, you mentioned it, and it really struck me as well, the phrase daring to listen.
Yeah.
And I think you use that phrase as a call to listen to the other person who is struggling and contemplating suicide. And the more I hear you, it almost sounds like you could turn that on yourself. And in a way, it's a call to listen to your own inner dialogue as you're working with someone who is themselves saying that they're struggling. And there may be all sorts of varieties of inner dialogues that we have. And you shared that with your son, and your inner dialogue at the time was feed him some pancakes. And you listened to that, and you know, sort of didn't just sort of abide by whatever it is that your inner dialogue was saying to you. And then you're also paying attention to some other elements in these conversations, like when someone is describing the problems that they have and you judge those problems to be insufficient. And and again, it's an example of that transparency that we really appreciate hearing you have, and daring to listen to yourself, I guess, so that you remain really focused on the needs of the other person first and foremost.
Yeah, I think it's about that, listening to what's happening within me. And sometimes I to also see, okay, so now I wasn't the best empathic me. How come? And it's often, you know, I've had bad sleep, I haven't eaten enough or done some exercise. So then I'm, you know, tired. I think empathy is hard. Accurate empathy isn't always easy. And it is a struggle. And sometimes we ourselves have trouble showing accurate empathy. So sometimes it's like, oh, we all want to be empathic people, and at the same time,
sure,
it's hard. Yeah. And sometimes harder.
Yeah, particularly given what you've been saying today and what Rory talked about before, is that when I am being empathic, that some of the emotions I'm going to be in the company of are very, very uncomfortable for me to experience too.
Yeah.
And as an empath, how well can I contain the experience that I'm having as I dare to listen to you? And as Seb was saying, is that internal dialogue, not only the cognitive dialogue, but also the emotional dialogue that I think that you're describing, is that, you know, that almost like your frustration with the trivialization of this issue. I'm too bloody busy. I've got more important people to talk to. Here you are talking about this. And just paying attention to that conversation, going, that's really interesting. You know, I'm getting really frustrated and angry with this person because of what they're describing, and just being, and I suppose from an empathic perspective, just being then be curious, you know, why is that happening for me, and what has this got to do with this conversation, and perhaps what's that teaching me about this other person and their experience of their conversations with other people? Is it that up until now other people have trivialized their call for help, and that even just acknowledging that, you know what, I imagine that many people, when you've talked about this before, simply dismiss it. But this sounds really important to you, and perhaps allows them to open the door to go into that deeper, more concrete place where this is the real reasons why I'm thinking like this about myself. But it's almost like they have to start at the safest place, and it's, I'm going to talk to you about something other than me, which is a movie I want to see.
Yeah.
And it sounds, again, that effort by the practitioner to tune in and understand what may be being communicated, inverted commas, in that trivial way, that's really the beginning of a thread to a more complex presentation about, can anybody hear me?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I think you're correct. And also, I think you said something really valuable, that if I'm thinking this about this person, then probably he or she has been met by other professionals like this. Oh, hmm. It's not that. A pat on the head, perhaps. Oh, it's not that. Or you said trivialized. You don't have it that difficult. Many people have it more difficult or something like that. So I think if I'm experiencing something, then probably other people have talked to him or her that way as well. And what does that to a person being met, you know, this over and over again? I think that's a valuable lesson that I try to incorporate in my trainings, you know, because we are quick to judge or to approve as well, or I am at least. Mm. And I think I'm struggling with that. And I think it's an inner dialogue as well, what I'm thinking and then what I'm actually saying as well. So it's a two-way street. And I think Bill Miller said that our last MI Mint conference, that empathy is just what happens in your head. It's being curious about the other person and then what you're saying, which is a complex reflection. So I think maybe not acting on your first response is useful. And also be kind to yourself. You know, I'm feeling this. I think looking at people kindly.
Yeah. So that you're describing maybe some kind of foundational ways to orient the practitioner in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can move towards some specific MI-related skills that you find to be really helpful. And Glenn, actually, it's making me think about another one of the questions that came through on Twitter, which I think was pertaining to MI skills in particular.
Yeah, so that comes from Wise Guys, whose handle is Wise Guys Now. And the question is, what are the best ways to elicit change talk around reasons not to take one's life?
So you mentioned before, Glenn, that maybe you're working with, you know, in healthcare and think you're supposed to talk to someone about compliance to their medicine or training program or whatever, or quit smoking or whatever, or mean social work, that you think you're supposed to work talk about housing or whatever. Hmm. And then this bump comes that. And MI, we often talk about what am I supposed to motivate that person to? And maybe it's compliance or to start with a new medicine or to start looking for housing. And I think when we talk about MI suicide prevention, what is the thing that we're trying to motivate them to is to continue to stay alive. So I think we need to change focus. So what am I now trying to motivate that person to? Okay, so it's continue to stay alive. And I don't think that's controversial to try to motivate people to continue to stay alive. And when I train people in suicide prevention or using MI, I change the word change talk and sustain talk, which is the two we use. And I try to rephrase it. So change talk is, what do we want to hear more? We want to hear more reasons, ability and need and desire to stay alive. So we want to hear more life talk.
Mm.
And we want to hear less, we want to turn down the death talk or the self-loathing talk. Because sometimes, you know, what's a person who's considering taking their life is supposed to change. Maybe it's the society around and everything. So sometimes talking about change talk is hard. So I try to use life talk and listen to the glimpse of life talk that comes through. And I think when I listen to the question, it's more like, is there another sort of MI to use when talking to people who are considering suicide? And it's really not. It's just, what am I trying to steer the conversation to? I want to hear more reasons about staying alive. And I think it's a valuable thing. It's, you know, how to turn down the sustain talk or the death talk. We want to soften it up. So if they say everything is hopeless, maybe today is a really bad day.
Mm.
We're not saying, because yesterday you applied for summer job, as I mentioned before, or right now it feels hopeless. We don't say that life is hopeless. Right now you're feeling like this. To acknowledge that these are true feelings and they're to you.
So it's almost like it's the opposite of an amplified reflex, and you're purposely turning the volume down on some of you're reframing some of my statements to make them smaller, but while acknowledging that I still have them.
Yeah, exactly. And also, so the person don't say, and sometimes, you know, so it sounds like today is a really, really bad day. And maybe, you know, has something happened today or has it been like this for a long time? Because we know if something's just happened, then it might be more acute. But, and then I sometimes ask, and then it sounds like you have days that aren't this shitty or you really have to come from underneath. But that's eliciting change talk or life talk. So then it sounds like you have better days. And they talk about the better days and what they want from life. I think we need to stay very long in what's really, really difficult. And I'm not a therapist. Maybe someone who is would do an excellent job in that. And at the same time, I think they really want to, you know, get to talk about what's keeping them in life. And I think we think we need really learn more about what's really the problem. And that's not always really helpful. I think we can all try to look for the glimpse of hope that's there, as well as acknowledging that they're really struggling. So looking for the talk that you feel is moving forward, moving towards wanting to stay alive. And that could be going to bed at night, or, you know, if a person is at the doctor's office or at the social works office, they came for a reason, didn't they? So yet you're feeling this, and yet you came to me today. So what are you hoping for today, perhaps? So, you know, saying that this this is accurate and you're feeling this, as well as trying to look ahead. And, you know, it sounds like it's been what I often say when I talk to people or calling or chatting. It sounds like it's been a struggle, you know, contacting us. And thank you for doing that. How come you chose to get in? Or how come you chose to come to me today, even though you're feeling this? Because in that, there's something, you know, in the actions. Lies the courage. It's not, I'm not going around, you know, being courageous. It's in the actions that we make, I think, sometimes. And, you know, like doing really difficult things, like picking up the phone and daring to call someone that you don't know, because this feeling is so strong. I need someone to talk to, and I really need someone to listen to me. I mean, that's really, really courageous. So we talked about that prior, as well as acknowledging and really looking for affirmations on their actions, you know, like their strides and strengths, keeping them, because they feel that I've accomplished nothing. I still feel like this. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, yet you called.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I talked to someone who said, you know, they dropped out of school because they, you know, no one, he wanted to be a psychologist, and said, no one wants a psychologist who feels like this. And I'm like, and yet, how come you, knowing you felt like this, how come you still applied to become a psychologist? And then you get a lot of values, because I want to make a difference to other people. And, you know, we know that in MI, we often talk about values being a really strong, could really influence us to making difficult changes in our lives. And when we don't live our life as we want to, or as the values we have, that could also be a strong way to make a change, or beginning to think about staying alive. And also, if I connect back to what I talked about, psychological accidents, it's also, you know, being so trapped in your feelings that it's dark and hopeless right now. And that's when, you know, oh, there's a train coming, I'm going to jump, and or I'm overwhelmed with my feelings. So we need to help the person up and calm the feelings down, the limbic system down. And then, you know, so they can get back to their own thoughts about, you know, I also have all of this. And sometimes when it's hard, I ask a person, oh, but what, how's your week been? Or how's your day been? And then, you know, they tell me, you know, what they've done during the week. And, you know, they've been working, seeing friends, babysitting their little brother, or went to the movies, and or went to the gym. And people do a lot of stuff. And that's for me as well, to see that this person has a lot of going on. And at the same time, for me, not judging, oh, this is a person who only feels like this, and broaden the perspective that these thoughts can come to actually almost anyone. And it could be me, and it could be anyone. And, you know, like broadening my perspective that this is a person who has a lot of things going on, and it's not just that thing or that diagnose or that problem that we're trying to solve. I think that's valuable to me to see, you know, in line to be more empathic.
Yeah, it's like acknowledging that there's a richness to someone's life, regardless of what they are showing up with in terms of the specific problem or diagnosis. And it also sounds like there's several things that you are attuned to. One is this notion of life talk versus death talk. And in doing that, maybe the double-sided reflection is a skill that you're using quite a bit, where you are respectfully acknowledging the death talk that is emerging, that life is not worth living, or that nothing I do turns out well, and offering a reflection of change talk that would be emerging. Even if there's the change talk that's always present when someone's in the room with you, the fact that they've showed up to be in the room with you or on the phone in a conversation. So that's one thing. Another thing that it seems like you're really attuned to is opportunities for affirmation. Yeah. And that something that may be present in most people who are contemplating suicide, and it's quite a shift for someone to make as a practitioner perhaps, but to view their ongoing struggle through the lens of courage, as opposed to through the lens of how difficult life is for them and how it's weighing them down. That may be true, but viewing it as courage and finding an opportunity to name it that way can be very, very powerful. Yeah. And then if I add a third thing that it seemed like you're really paying attention to is opportunities to discuss someone's values, which I imagine is a way to not get so stuck in the back and forth content that people can get really bogged down with, and that, you know, tapping into and exploring someone's values is a way maybe to loosen up the conversation, so it's not only about life and death, and it's about what's important to this person and maybe what's missing in the person's life, which is one of the things, one of the origins perhaps of the person contemplating their own death. So a lot of things that you're really attuned to from an MI perspective that seem to be really helpful.
I think you summarized quite well, Seb, what I'm trying to do in trainings overall, and specifically in trainings regarding people who are considering suicide. It's affirm, 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 affirm. I think that's really, really the best skill you could have. Not just the skill, I think it's also looking at people as they have resources instead of having problems. And I think that helps us being more non-judgmental of other people. So I think it's both training spirit and skills, you know, the affirmations, and also the double-sided complex reflections, beginning with the death talk and steering to the life talk. I think it's, you know, it shows empathy that you could feel two ways about something, as well as turning down the death talk and steering towards the life talk. And the fun part or part is that I train, you know, when training volunteers, a lot of people don't have a professional background in healthcare or in social work or anything like that. And they get it. They get it quite easily, actually. They feel understood, and at the same time, you know, what we're steering towards. I think that's quite amazing. And also, you know, I have these little cases when training people in suicide prevention that are really, really dark. You know, what you could hear, it's 5 or 6 sentences and, you know, like little cases, and it's everything is so dark for these people. And I do it, you know, a few hours in training and trained a bit of affirmations before. And, you know, at first they say, oh, this is, I can't find anything. And then per case, they could find, you know, 5 or 10 things to affirm in different way, you know, like struggles. And even though you've been through all of this, you're still able to be kind to other people was something that lingered on. So before, you know, like they would look at this person as, oh, it's hopeless and it feels so dark. And how am I going to get out of this darkness as well?
Mm.
And then, you know, I think affirmations is amazing, if I would say that. And really trusting, you know, affirm the process and not you are this and that. And that could be useful as well. And really coming, saying something about their strides that they're doing. And their struggles. And it sounds, maybe some say, it sounds like it hasn't been easy for you, yet you're doing this. I mean, don't we all want to be a person that's really struggling?
It sounds like you're very sensitive to the impact of good practice, or more particularly some of the skills that you're identifying, that the power of an affirmation, the power of being seen, the power of being understood. And and what's lovely to hear as well is that acknowledgement that you don't have to be a professional to use motivational interviewing well, that motivational interviewing is available to everyone who wishes to help, and that you don't become a good helper by becoming a professional. You become a good helper by doing good helping. And it sounds like one of the things that good helpers are doing is that when they're practicing helping people, that the affirmations that they're offering are really responding to the challenges or the elements or the aspects of an individual who presents themselves that perhaps they're taking for granted about themselves, that looking after their nephew or doing things for other people, that you can see the effort or the positive intention that they have just begun to take for granted. Well, that's what everybody does. And you're just noticing the effort that they're putting into that and just helping them to notice it for themselves. And it sounds like that in itself potentially has the opportunity to add light to that life talk, add energy to that life talk. For the individual, and then back to that whole aspect of self-determination, that it ultimately they talk themselves into life, that you don't rescue them, but you help them find a way of describing what it is about themselves that is already those values that are meaningful to them, where they already have some roots so that they can grow from there, that they want to be a kind person. You want to help, you help them see where the kindness is already present that they're maybe not paying attention to, and if they pay a bit more attention to that. And that sounds a bit like, I just want to refer to one more tweet that we got. We got a series of tweets from Rippin, who is at Angela Fell, who works for Samaritans, which is an organisation in the UK.
Yeah. I know.
That offers suicide interventions. And what's important for Rippin and her conversations with us is that the philosophy within Samaritans is that whole idea of self-determination, that they recognize this person has the right to decide whether to live or not. That they're not going to tell them not to do it, but they're going to help them explore, as you say, that ambivalence. Mm-hmm. And I think that's again back to the challenge that perhaps all of us are experiencing for the first few times that we meet it, is we can't allow this person to talk about dying, we can't allow this person to talk about this stuff because it's just going to make it happen. And the reassuring message is that, yes, giving them a chance to talk about it is the important, but it's been heard, but hearing the two aspects, not just the dark side, and not necessarily spending time in the dark side on purpose. It's about that you can either face towards the past and the difficulties, or as you have described, as you change the focus to life talk and change direction in what you observe and invite the conversation to go in that way. So there's so much that you've been giving us today, and as often is the case, Emma, that when we come to the time where we start to draw our conversation to an end, there's still more to do.
Yeah.
But before we do begin to close, we always offer our guests the opportunity to explore or describe anything that's happening for them at the minute that has caught their attention. That doesn't necessarily have to be MI focused, but...
Well, I think I've been on the path of MI for 11 years. And I think the more I learn about it, the more I think I need to learn as well. But I think that MI, it's given me very much. And, you know, in the context of communicating to other people and also looking at other people more kindly and also at myself more kindly, I think. So I'm trying to find exercises that train both skill and the spirit, because I think the spirit is so powerful, you know, looking at each other more kindly And I think we would have a kinder world. So I'm really trying to design trainings where really giving much punch in the exercises. So they train both skill and spirit. And I think that's sometimes hard. And also really, really discovered myself the really power of affirmations and really trying to know, like, now I forgot her name, but who looked at a more fixed mindset or flexible mindset, that how we talk to our kids, how they will handle challenges in their life. I look at my son, he's 2, and you know, when he started walking, he was about 1, and he, you know, tried to walk over the thresholds in our apartments, and then he fell, and you know, he started crawling again over, and then he got up, and then he asked for help. And then one day I was sitting in the kitchen and he was walking over the threshold by himself. He just looked at me, he put his arms up high, he just looked at me and smiled, and then he went on. And I just nodded at him. I saw what you were doing, and it's great, and you've been struggling. That was what I wanted to say. And I saw, so I think we have it in us to really try and try and try again until we succeed. When we are born, and then something happens along the way, we get more. There's a Swedish psychologist that wrote a book, 5 times more love, that we're supposed to give our children positive reactions 5 times more than for every no, you know. And I don't think we as adults are any different. I think we've been trained in the society that look for what's not going well and fix that instead of building on what's working and what we are struggling. And even though it didn't go very well, we continue to get up every morning and continue to do that. And, you know,
right.
Looking at that more, I think it's very, very powerful.
Just using that story that you described, it's almost like the client coming to us with any presentation, but in this instance, the suicidal thoughts, are potentially the child coming across the threshold, and we notice them. It's just that being noticed is what we're all looking for.
Yeah, that's a really nice reflection. I'm gonna use that, Glenn, my training. Yeah, but I think looking at our children and how they evolve, just supporting them along, it has a much, for me anyway, to see how to do MI trainings and what can MI contribute to. Because as a practitioner, I can only be there for a short amount of time, and I have to give back what I see in them so they can use that, or the other 23 hours of the day or 167 hours of the week. So what I'm trying to give back what I see that they already have within them, so they can use that, because I'm not there to tell them every single way, oh, great job. They have to, you know, okay, this didn't work out, but I'm a person that keeps on trying, even though that didn't go that well. So, and we all use our resources, maybe not in the best of ways. So.
Yeah, with this looking forward question, or what do you have going on presently? It sounds like there's both professional and personal pursuits and ways of, I guess what I'm hearing is these mini like MI moments that appear not out of any sort of planning or structure, but just as life unfolds and you can acknowledge and recognize the experience. Not that everything about life is about MI, of course, but there are ways of viewing these moments through the lens of an affirmation or a self-affirmation even, and thinking about how some of the lessons that we take in as parents, actually we can easily generalize to being human and how we want to enrich our own connection with other people and ourselves.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So as we close, another thing that we ask our guests is if they are willing to receive questions from the audience. They may want to follow up with you on a particular topic or ask more questions. So if you are willing, how should one contact you?
Yeah, I love discussing MI. So everyone is always free to contact me. So it's Emma, E-M-M-A dot. So now my difficult last name will come. So it's B-R-A-C-O-N sweden.ier@gmail.com.
And just to remind people that to continue to contact us or to make comments about this or other episodes, our Twitter is @ChangeTalking. Our Facebook page is Talking to Change. Our Instagram is Talking to Change Podcast. And our email address is podcast@glennhines.com.
Wonderful. Well, Emma, we really, really appreciate it. This has been a wonderful conversation about a difficult subject, and I am certain people will take a lot from it and be able to put both general things and really specific things into practice. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been really great being here.
Thanks, Emma.
All right, Glenn. Until next time.
Indeed. Thanks, Emma.
Yeah.
Take care.
Okay.